Welcome to this reading of the Business Record, Central Iowa's Business Weekly. I'm Pat Steele. All material heard on IRIS is intended for the use of listeners with print disabilities. And here is our first story from the March 8th, 2024 edition of the Business Record. Registration is now open for the 2024 Iowa Classrooms Plus Workplaces Summit. The 2024 statewide Iowa Classrooms Plus Workplace Summit will be held April 10th at the Iowa Events Center in Des Moines, presented by the Iowa Governor's STEM Advisory Council at the Iowa Department of Education. The event invites Iowans from industry organizations, governmental agencies, elected officials, and students to discuss learning environments that link classroom learning to real-world career pathways. ExcelN Senior Policy Fellow Christy Hovanovitz and Code Org Chief Academic Officer Pat Youngpraded will speak at the event, and followed by a presentation from Kemen Industries. And the registration deadline, you can do the registration deadline on the Department of Education webpage. Our next story is headline, What's the Plan for Former Walgreens Space in Downtown Des Moines? This is an article written by Kathy Bolton of the Business Record. Walgreens, a longtime fixture in downtown Des Moines, shuttered its store in late February, leaving property owner Walmart Capital with about 12,000 square feet of vacant space to fill. The former Walgreens was located in street-level space on the east side of the 25-story financial center at 606 Walnut Street. Jesse Bunny, director of operations for Walmart Capital, told the Business Record that Walgreens has 5 years remaining on its lease. Walmart Capital is working with Walgreens on either a buyout of the lease or a sublease. If they buy out, we will likely demise it and try to make it part of the renovation, Bunny wrote in an email. Walmart Capital is renovating the financial center, including adding up to 198 apartment units on the lower 15 floors of the building. The street-level portion of the property is expected to include a restaurant, cafe, coffee shop, mailroom, and bike storage. Cyfox named a top producer at CBRE. He is a senior vice president at CBRE and has been named as a top 20% producer and a top 20 multifamily sales producer in the firm's America's Brokerage Business for 2023. The list recognizes 600 top brokers across North America, Canada, and Latin America. Fox is the only broker in Iowa to make the list. He joined CBRE's Des Moines office in 2015 and specializes in the acquisition, disposition, and repositioning of multifamily assets in Iowa on behalf of investors and owners. To date, he has participated in the sale of more than 7,000 apartment units totaling more than $1 billion. It is the third year Fox has been named the top producer in CBRE's Iowa office, said Bill Wright, managing director of CBRE's West Des Moines office. This recognition is a testament to the determination and hard work of Cy and his business partner, Ray Hamilton, Wright said. They have successfully built CBRE's well-respected multifamily business in Des Moines. Fox was also named the Iowa Commercial Real Estate Association 2023 Broker of the Year. He received the 2023 Platinum Broker Award by CREXI, and CoStar included him on its Power Brokers list from 2016 to 2023. Elsewhere from the March 8th edition of the Business Record, Bondurant's Green District Downtown Redevelopment Plan. Here's a closer look. This is an article written by Michael Crum, a staff writer for the Business Record. Bondurant's Green District Downtown Redevelopment Plan will embrace the community's agricultural heritage while building on the growth the community has experienced in recent years. That's according to City Administrator Marquetta Oliver. The redevelopment of the 24-acre site would also be among the few similar developments across the country and around the world, according to Scott Jerzynski, managing partner of the 101 LLC, which is partnering with the city on the project. There are only a couple of them in the United States that I've seen, and in Europe, Africa, and Australia, that have retrofitted grain elevators into hotels, apartments, and museums, Trzynski said. I've been in the construction business my whole life, and this is kind of a new avenue for me. And that's what I find creative is the challenge of doing this retrofit. There's these grain towers all over the place that are vacant, and can these be retrofitted? Jasinski said that to his knowledge, the Bondurant project would be the first to incorporate multiple uses of the retrofitting grain towers. The Business Record reported on the plan when it was announced last week, but wanted to learn more. They spoke with city leaders and Jasinski about the timeline for construction and what it could mean for the city of Bondurant and the region, and here's what the Business Record learned. The city announced the adoption of the plan to redevelop the property at 101 Lincoln Street, which houses the 140-foot tall grain elevators owned by Landis Cooperative. The organization stopped using the elevators in 2021. The plan includes the development of a commercial district that would include space for retail and restaurants, an area to build townhomes, an indoor recreation complex, public gathering space, and the transformation of the giant elevators into spaces for condominiums, a hotel, and event space. The decision to move forward with the plan comes after Bondurant City Council hired OPN Architects in 2022 to conduct a study to assess the feasibility of redeveloping the grain elevators. According to the results, it appears that the existing structure has the capacity to support conversion into a multi-story residential or commercial building with modest structural remediation. The grain elevators are built of 8-inch thick reinforced concrete walls constructed on a 3-foot thick reinforced concrete mat. While some structural modifications and cosmetic repairs would be needed, the structure appears to be in adequate condition to support the new usage, the OPN report said. Redevelopment of the site as an extension of the community's downtown was identified in the city's 2022 comprehensive plan and has the potential to attract more than $100 million in private development, according to city officials. Bondurant is working with the 101 LLC as part of a public-private partnership to redevelop the site. The 101 LLC is in the process of purchasing the site from Landis, and Jasinski said he expects to close on the property late spring. While he would not disclose the purchase price, he said an offer was made and accepted and that he's in the process of doing due diligence before closing the property. One project planned by Jasinski is a distillery, which would first open as a production facility with a tasting room and space for meetings. It would eventually expand into a larger production area with a restaurant and event space, according to Jasinski. He said it would be his plan to someday move into a condominium in the converted grain elevator when the project is complete. The site contains multiple groupings of grain elevators. The older ones adjacent to a former railroad track bed could be partially demolished and repurposed for a variety of potential uses. Jasinski said he has talked about some kind of a partial demo to make it look creative, make it look inviting where people could stop and rest along the bike trail, maybe have climbing activities inside or on certain summer evenings, put a movie up on the side of it. The newer grain towers, which are gray in color and closer to the road, would be involved in the retrofit for condominiums and a hotel, Jasinski said. City leaders say they hope to have the project fully built out and completed in about 5 years, although the officials and Jasinski acknowledge it might take longer to complete the grain tower conversion. First, the city must make some infrastructure improvements, including the extension of Lincoln Street to tie in the site to Bondurant's existing downtown. Once those improvements are complete, the first phase of the project would likely be the housing, which Oliver said would be higher density that would flow into nearby housing and be a nice buffer between the residential and the more intense commercial uses. Oliver said, we're collaborating with the developer, and clearly there's some infrastructure improvements that would be ours to make, and that is development driven. Realistically, the first thing to happen is the multifamily housing. Oliver said the progress of the project will depend on market conditions, but that Jasinski has been a good partner and is working to make sure all of the right connections are made and that the city is doing everything it should be to make the project a reality. So hopefully 5 years from now, we'll be like, wow, I can't believe that's done already, she said. I'd love to see it over the next 5 years come to fruition. Maggie Murray, the city's director of planning and community development, said the Green Elevator redevelopment is a unique dream that is a difficult project to assign a timeline, but the downtown and housing development could be possible in 5 years. But the other developments, such as the retail and commercial district and an indoor sports center, could expedite the need for a hotel and more restaurants, Oliver said. If you have a child in team sports, they go all over for that. Imagine staying in a hotel that used to be a Green Elevator or going to a nice craft brewery, she said. Tuzinski said he'd love to see the Green Tower project completed in 5 years, but that there's a lot of legwork with that, trying to get whatever financing needs to be put together on that. We haven't even done any preliminary cost on what something like that would cost. But I would hope we'd get the majority of the commercial buildings in place by that time and the multifamily rolling along at that point in time. The $100 million in private investment does include the Green Elevator redevelopment, Tuzinski said. Murray said, I think this Green District plan is a continuation of the existing momentum in our downtown. If you do a Google Street View from, I think, even 2015 or 2016, it kind of looks like a ghost town, not a lot of businesses downtown. And now probably in the last 5 or 6 years, there's a whole new number of businesses within the downtown and those still wanting to potentially open this year. So we've got some strong momentum there. So why not carry that over that momentum to the Green District? Oliver said Bondurant is out of space downtown and the Green District plan will expand the downtown and open land for further economic growth and placemaking opportunities. I do think it raises the profile of our community, but I think it's key for us to take advantage of recreational tourism. Oliver referenced visitors to the Chautauqua Bottoms area, or those riding the Chautauqua Valley Trail, which passes through the city, and families attending weekend sporting tournaments in the area as people the Green District development could attract. And it also preserves our history, she said. The city grew up around the co-op. That's the heart of the community. So being able to repurpose those is really important. Our comprehensive plan talks about wanting to embrace our agricultural heritage and preserving our history. The Green District Downtown Redevelopment Plan also will help achieve the city's goal of preserving a strong hometown feel, according to Murray. We learned through the comprehensive planning process that our residents appreciate the feeling that Bondurant has a unique sense of place. So how do we keep playing on that unique identity as we're also continuing to grow? Tuzinski said the project, when done, would not only be a draw for more visitors to spend their dollars in Bondurant, but he also sees it as being a model for other communities where great vacant Green Elevators exist. I would love that other developers look at the vacant ones around the area and look at doing the same, he said. Wouldn't that be cool if something could be duplicated in other regions in Iowa to provide workforce housing, maybe, provide entertainment venues, retrofitting these old structures, and rehabbing areas of a city that needs it? And again, that article is written by Michael Crum, a senior staff writer at the Business Record. Our next story is the city of West Des Moines announced that the audit from its Forbes classified the city as a low-risk auditee due to several years of positive audit results. The city's most recent audit for the fiscal year ending June 30, 2023, found no material misstatements or significant deficiencies. A copy of the audit report is available for review on the Auditor of State's website. The audit results show city finances are maintained in a responsible manner, and I'm proud of our employees' work to ensure we're completely transparent with how we manage and spend our budget. And that's a statement from City Manager of West Des Moines, Tom Hayden. Des Moines Public Schools' longest-serving board member, Terry Caldwell Johnson, has submitted her resignation after nearly 2 decades due to health issues. That's according to the Des Moines Register. In recent months, Caldwell Johnson has been attending school board meetings online after announcing a cancer diagnosis last year. She has also pulled back from her role as president and CEO of Oak Ridge Neighborhood, a Des Moines nonprofit that provides services such as housing for families in need, according to a news release. The board of directors has selected Kristen Clayton, vice president of finance and administration, to take on Caldwell Johnson's role as acting CEO at Oak Ridge. Caldwell Johnson wrote in her resignation letter, "It has been my privilege to have been elected to serve on the Des Moines Public School Board over the past 18 years, and my greatest honor is to have served three terms as the board chair. Our district's commitment to student outcomes and policy-focused governance has created a win-win for our district and our current and future students." Caldwell Johnson was honored as Business Record Woman of Influence in 2002 and wrote about Oak Ridge Neighborhood for Business Publications Corporation 2023 Pillars of Philanthropy publication. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources is seeking nominations for the Iowa Farm Environmental Leader Award. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources is encouraging Iowans to nominate individuals or families for the 2024 Iowa Farm Environmental Leader Awards. Nominees should be Iowa farmers and landowners who implement proven practices to improve water quality and incorporate farming practices that conserve natural resources and also actively serve as leaders within the Iowa agriculture community. Nominations will be accepted through May 6th, 2024. The recipients of the award will be honored during the ceremony on August 14, 2024 at the Iowa State Fair, where Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and other state leaders will present each awardee with an Iowa Farm Environmental Leader Award sign and certificate. Since the creation of the award in 2012, 777 farm families have been recognized. World Food Prize Hall of Laureates to host an international ESG summit in June. The Hue Valuation Summit will be held at the World Food Prize Hall of Laureates from June 10th to the 12th. The event will bring analysts, investors, and policymakers together to apply the Human Impact Unit valuation methodology to 12 environmental, social, and governance projects. The Hue methodology provides investors a way to accurately value ESG projects and compare projects across different contexts, including carbon emissions, water quality, and food insecurity. The summit is expected to generate a new wave of investment into environmental initiatives, according to a news release. Chris Draper, the CEO of ESG, Regenerative Authentication Credits, and local chair for the summit, said, "Serious issues in our state like water quality or topsoil erosion need a new mechanism for driving the level of community investment that produces change. This summit will help expand impact, investing beyond carbon by putting human well-being at the heart of these investments." Homeward Iowa releases study identifying key recommendations for improving homelessness system in Polk County. Polk County's homeless response system is not equipped to respond to rising rates of homelessness, according to findings of a recent study published by Homeward Iowa, a homelessness planning organization in Housing Innovations, an Ohio-based research firm. The homelessness system needs assessment and centralized intake evaluation found that Polk County will need to invest an additional $19.65 million to help the area's homeless population become permanently housed. The study found that the local homelessness service providers do not have the financial resources or capacity to address the homelessness crisis alone. That's according to Angie Arthur, Homeward Iowa's executive director. Funded by the Nationwide Foundation, the research focused on establishing an optimal system to address homelessness. This ideal system would organize the right amount of resources in the most impactful way. The study identifies three key steps to maximize the impact of additional spending. Number one, build 29 additional units of emergency shelter specifically for families. Second, expand rehousing capacity for single adults. Third, institute housing-focused case management for every person experiencing homelessness. The report recommends offering housing-focused case management to anyone in the homelessness system for more than 14 days. The study also suggests that updating the current centralized intake system, which is operated by primary health care, which serves as the front door for Polk County's homelessness system. While meeting federal standards, the system could enhance efficiency to better serve the approximately 3,000 households experiencing homelessness in Polk County. Nationwide Foundation President Chad Jester said in a statement, "Addressing homelessness in Polk County will take a collaborative approach, and the Nationwide Foundation is committed to providing resources to increase system efficiencies. The results gathered from this study will enable our providers to address service gaps and realign their resources to better support those who are experiencing homelessness. To learn more about Homeward and to access the Homelessness System Needs Assessment and Centralized Intake Evaluation, you can visit their website." And next, we take a look at a column Business Record does occasionally on people in Central Iowa. And this one is a closer look and looks at Julia Franklin, who's the executive director of Mainframe Studios. Nicole Grundmeier of the Business Record wrote this article. "When Iowa artist Julia Franklin was a child growing up in North Texas, she would melt crayons on the hot light bulb of a bedroom lamp. She recalls this distinctly because she uses wax in her artwork today. I remember I loved the smell. I loved the quality of melted wax," said Franklin, who took over as executive director of Mainframe Studios, the artist workspace nonprofit downtown Des Moines that opened in 2017. "I would dig in the backyard with my pink Baskin-Robbins spoon and create moats in little cities just by digging in the dirt and playing in the mud every day and having to be hosed off before I could come into the house. Art is messy. There's this idea of play that should be a part of what you do." And she said, "I've always been making." Franklin previously worked on grants handed out by Bravo Greater Des Moines to arts and cultural organizations. She started her new job at Mainframe on a First Friday, an event from 5 to 8 p.m. the first Friday of every month that includes music, food, drinks, themed exhibitions, and five floors of artists and shopping. At Mainframe, she took over from Siobhan Spain, who had overseen the project since its opening. The Business Record caught up with Franklin recently, and she explained how she approaches the job and what is ahead for Mainframe. "First and foremost," Franklin says, "the job is to take care of the artists in the building to ensure that we're meeting our mission and provide affordable workspace for creatives. That's my day-to-day. Is the building safe? Are artists safe? Do they have what they need to thrive? And then there's things that support all of that, like fundraising, working with the board to make sure governance is happening, that oversight. It's managing budgets to keep things sustainable. That's the whole point. In some ways, I see it as a relationship building with tenants themselves, the artists, and with community members." How many artists do you have? Well, right now we have 181 studios, which I also liken to small businesses. They are all small businesses, and we have artists who share spaces, and we do have some nonprofits. We're over 220 people who work in the building on a regular basis. Business Record asked her, "What does a typical day look like for you?" "I have yet to find a typical day, and I love that. The job is never boring. There will never be the same day. A lot of it is meetings with individual tenants, with community members. It's also solving a building emergency and helping support the team in that way. It's also helping plan for the future, especially for First Friday events, for any professional development that we do for artists." Next question, "When did you know that you wanted to be an artist?" "I did not have an art class until I was a sophomore in college. I hadn't been to a museum until I was a sophomore in college. It wasn't something my family did. It wasn't discouraged, but it wasn't encouraged either. But I think I've always been crafty, creative. All of my English reports would have illustrations with them. I think about my life. My dad took his own life and died by suicide when I was 16. I have a feeling that was the moment. How do you tell that story? How do you move on from something like that? That really just changes the course of your life. When I was in college, still not quite even sure how to articulate what happened. Words weren't doing it, but art could. Art was so interesting because a shape or a color could represent a mood or a moment. There were ways to use those symbols to help start to address some of that trauma, some of that impact. It still took decades for me to really tell the story of that experience and look at my father in a different way and start to understand the pressures of the world. Do most artists prefer or need studio space like Mainframe offers to separate work from home? Artists are usually making work, and it's very solitary, so they are making work alone in the studio or alone at home. What mainframe affords is actually a clean space for you to come in and make work, and you can leave it in process. You don't have to clean up. So if you're doing this at home on your kitchen table, you don't get to have it out all the time. And so mainframe allows you to come in and work daily, so your practice is much more disciplined in that regard. Next question was, do you have time to make art? Franklin said, I've not since I started this job. I set a deadline, so I have a small collaboration with another artist on the 29th of February, and we'll be doing some small work together. And so, yes, it's still part of my life. It's just not as much a part of it as it was a couple of months ago. What do you think is the most effective way to tell the story of Iowa's art scene? That's an interesting question. Social media videos seem to be what people want to consume, and it has to be digestible in 30 seconds or less. A lot of times, that just yields itself to the final art product, showing that rather than maybe the process of how ideas happen and are formed and how those manifest in a physical work, artwork creation. That's it. It's how do you tell the story and how do you get people to connect with things in such short chunks of time? That's the challenge for any business, but I'm also reminded that mainframe is in the details. I went to an event. The videos that were shown were all shot and edited here at mainframe. The setting was at mainframe for some of the interviews. The jewelry someone wore was from a mainframe jeweler. How do you point out all those things? The food that was served, some of that was made by Tangerine, who's here at mainframe. Some of the dresses that people wore at the event were made by mainframe fashion designers. So you can see mainframe is all-encompassing. It surrounds us. And how do you point that out? Remind people that the flair and richness of life is coming from the creativity in this building. Now, the business record does a little bit of an at-glance, and Franklin is 50 years old. Her hometown is Wichita Falls, Texas. She has a BFA in sculpture and printmaking from Midwestern State University in Wichita Falls, and a master's in FA in sculpture and ceramics at TCU in Fort Worth. Family, she has a spouse, David, or Davin, I should say. He helps when I create large room installation. He helps build walls and figures out physics for me. And they have a daughter, Sky, who's 21 years old, who's taught her a lot about learning to look and appreciate all the details. She lives in West Des Moines, and activities include art as the center of everything, but also traveling, reading, and sunshine, she says. So that's a look at the new director of mainframe, Julia Franklin. Now we move to some economic news, and our top story in this category is Creighton's Business Conditions Index slumps below growth neutral in February. This is a report compiled by Business Records staff. After climbing above growth neutral in December and January, the Creighton University Mid-American Business Conditions Index dropped below the 50.0 growth neutral threshold for February. The index is a leading economic indicator for the 9-state region stretching from Minnesota to Arkansas and ranges between 0 and 100, with 50 representing growth neutral. Ernie Goss said in a prepared statement, "The overall index, much like the United States reading, has hovered around growth neutral for the last 3 months. Additionally, supply managers remain pessimistic regarding the 2024 outlook, with only 14.3% of them expecting a 2024 economic expansion." Goss is the Jack A. McAllister Chair in Regional Economics at Creighton. Over the past 12 months, Iowa's job openings sank by 27%, or 24.5%, while layoffs fell by 1,200, or 16.8%, and that's according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics data. Iowa's overall February index slipped to 49.3 from 51.8 in January. Components of the overall February index included new orders at 50.7, production or sales at 40.6, delivery lead time at 57.9, employment at 39.1, and inventories at 61.2. After climbing to 50.0 for December, the 9-state region's employment gauge tumbled to its lowest level since June 2020 in January at 39.1, but rose to 42.9 in February. Goss said that over the past 12 months, according to U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics data, the region's job openings declined by 156,000, while the number of layoffs fell by 2,000. The wholesale inflation gauge for the month fell to 61.9 from January's 71.7. The confidence index, which looks ahead 6 months, improved slightly to 33.4 from 31.9 in January. And you're listening to this week's edition, the March 8th edition of the Business Record. Our thanks to the folks at Business Publications for providing a copy of the Business Record to IRIS so that we can read it for you. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at 515-243-6833. Now let's get back to the Business Record. Okay, we now turn our attention to opinion section of the Business Record. And the first one is the Elbert Files, Iowans and UFOs. This is a column written by David Elbert of the Business Record. The modern era of UFO sightings began mid-year 1947, shortly after I was born, which helps explain my lifelong fascination with unidentified flying objects and why I was drawn to a new book by technology writer Garrett M. Graff. The title of that book is UFO, the Inside Story of the U.S. Government's Search for Alien Life Here and Out There, and it traces the history of the phenomenon from the Old Testament, when the prophet Ezekiel reported seeing a flaming wheel in the sky, to today's computer-driven searches for extraterrestrial intelligence. Early sightings in this country include a six-month period from 1896 to 1897, when mysterious airships were seen from California to West Virginia moving at speeds of 5 to 150 miles per hour. One report was from an Iowa railroad engineer who said he paced the object with his train. The Iowa sighting was reported on April 10, 1897 in the Detroit Free Press. The article, available online at newspapers.com, said the object had a blazing headlight, a smooth hull, dark wing-like extensions, and made a hissing sound as it glides through the air. A follow-up article on May 4th, which Graff does not mention, said the object was a cross between a kite and a balloon. It was created by John Sorter, a railroad telegraph operator. Sorter admitted he built several using a balloon the size and shape of a large bed mattress and capable of carrying railroad lanterns. Some of the kites were cut loose from ground tethers and allowed to soar off through space in the same manner as a balloon, the follow-up article said. Graff's research uncovered declassified materials that placed thousands of recent sightings in one of four categories. And they are, one, visual anomalies, two, natural phenomena, including ball lightning, plasma, etc., number three, unreported advanced military technologies, and four, unexplainable sightings. There were enough items in the unexplainable category to pique the interest of four presidents, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, and Barack Obama, all expressed interest in UFOs and to varying degrees suggested they would pull back the veil of secrecy, although none did to any meaningful degree. The 544-page book is organized on a timeline and features many recurring characters, including Carl Sagan and popular media productions ranging from The X-Files, E.T., Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Men in Black, and The Andromeda Strain. Two characters prominent in early chapters were born in Iowa. One was Donald Kehoe, who was born in Ottumwa in 1897, months after the kite balloon was sighted by railroad workers in eastern Iowa. Kehoe was a World War I pilot who turned to science fiction writing after helping manage Charles Lindbergh's 1927 coast-to-coast tour. He began writing about flying saucers in 1947. His 1950 article, called Flying Saucers Are Real, was said by Edward J. Rappel to be one of the most widely read and discussed magazine articles ever. Rappel coined the term unidentified flying object. He was born in Grundy Center, a decorated bombardier in World War II, and a 1951 graduate of Iowa State College. A year later, Rappel was tapped to lead the Project Blue Book, the Air Force's formal study of UFOs. He resigned in late 1953 when his staff was cut from 10 to 2. but Rappel remained involved until he died from a heart attack in 1960 at age 37. Kehoe died in 1988 at age 91. The men were occasionally paired in articles about UFO sightings during the 1950s, but they did not always see eye to eye. Rappel was interested in the science and believed there was something going on that needed deeper exploration by the government. Kehoe's early reporting was also fact-driven, and he became a leader of civilian efforts to explore UFO sightings. But over time, Kehoe's views and writing veered into what Rappel believed was sensationalism, and the two former Iowans parted ways. And that's it for the Elbert Files for this week. Again, that's a column written by David Elbert. He's been a longtime columnist for the Business Record. Our next opinion piece this week is on leadership, how to lead when you're not the boss. This is written by Susanna DeBacca, and she is the president and CEO of Business Publications Corporation. And here's what she wrote. In a past job, I had a talented individual on my team. I recognized her skills and asked her if she'd like to lead an innovative technology project we were working on. Her response was that this project was not in her job description, that even though she had time, she was not interested if she wasn't going to receive extra compensation. I then turned to another team member who immediately said yes. Although she had no background in this particular area, she was eager to learn and jumped into the new project wholeheartedly. She educated herself and quickly began to add value in getting others to adopt the new technology we'd invested in. When it came time for promotions, guess which team member advanced? The person who had said yes to the project got an elevated role, in part because she had developed valuable new skills, but largely because she had demonstrated both influence and leadership. Harvard Business Review article said, to become an influential person at work, we're often told we must rise through the ranks or collect a series of fancy credentials. But this is a big misconception, according to that article. The article asserts that most people don't think of themselves as leaders if not part of their title or job description. But leadership is a skill. Being an influential leader has little to do with your rank in your organization or your title. You can be a leader through your influence, regardless of whether you manage people or have a P&L. And as many of us have experienced, and as a recent Fast Company article headline pointed out, being a manager does not make you a leader. Leading when you are not the boss requires a certain mindset. A boss's authority or power may come from their level in the organization, their experience, or their resources. But a true leader's authority comes from their ability to influence others, whether that is in helping create policy, get a project done, or shape a pleasant and supportive workplace. You can add value regardless of your title. Even if you don't want more responsibility or a new job at your organization, you can still contribute simply through your leadership mindset. And if you are looking to advance, think about leveraging your influence in positive ways. As my example proved, people with a leadership mindset don't wait for a promotion to take on new challenges, but see them as an opportunity to develop or advance. At the end of the day, you can lead just by being a force for good, helping your colleagues and your boss improve productivity, generate new ideas, or have a more enjoyable workplace will ultimately add to everyone's success. Now, here are 10 ways, according to Suzanne DeBacca, that 10 ways that you can be a leader, even when you're not the boss. Number one, wield influence, not orders. Use positive persuasion rather than being in command mode with your colleagues. Number two, inspire. Think big. Explain the why and motivate your colleagues and leaders to do more and be more. Number three, seize opportunities. Say yes to learning experiences that strengthen both you and the organization. Number four, mentor. Share your skills and insights with others and be a listening ear. Five, commit time for growth. Prioritize your own learning and development and be willing to help others advance their skills. Next, be a connector. Put people and ideas together, always thinking of how to facilitate dialogue, innovation, or a positive culture. Next, be a part of the team. See yourself in the team, not outside it or above it. Ask, how can I help, rather than assuming that everything is someone else's job. Number eight, look for the good. Even when times are challenging, find what is positive and point it out. Number nine, innovate. Anyone can have good ideas. Be on the lookout for how to improve your organization and share your thoughts. And finally, number 10, say thank you. A great leader appreciates what others are doing. Recognize your colleagues and lift them up. And again, Susanna DeBacca wrote this article on leadership, and she's the president and CEO of Business Publications Corporation. Now turning to some education articles, the state of Iowa has announced $3.5 million to expand before-school, after-school programming. The Iowa Department of Education announced $3.5 million in competitive grants to Iowa schools to create or expand before- and after-school programs. All Iowa schools are eligible to apply for the Learning Beyond the Bell grant, which will offer schools up to $200,000 for staffing, evidence-based math and reading interventions, tutoring, transportation, and meals aligned with requirements in the National School Lunch Program. The application deadline for the Learning Beyond the Bell grant is noon on March 29th, and you can visit the Department of Education website for more information. Iowa Department of Education Director Mackenzie Snell said in a prepared statement, "In partnership with schools and community organizations, Learning Beyond the Bell will expand access to high-quality instructional and enrichment programs, engaging students in dynamic learning and supporting working families beyond the school day." In other education news, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds announced $1 million in initial funding for competitive grants to support school districts that partner with or create local child care centers to help more high school students earn a National Child Development Credential. Through the new Credentials for Child Care Careers grant, available through the Department of Education, eligible school districts can apply for up to $15,000 for each of the 2024-2025 and 2025-2026 school years. That's for a total of $30,000. Allowable costs include student exam fees, textbooks, CDA course materials, student stipends, licensed child care partner stipend, and other approved expenses that help remove barriers to participation. Application for the Credentials for Child Care Careers Grant will be accepted until noon on March 29th, and more information is available on the Iowa Department of Education website. Turning to workforce issues now, Governor Kim Reynolds and Iowa Workforce Development recently announced deployment of the Iowa Works Mobile Workforce Center. That is a new 32-foot-long vehicle that will deliver workforce services throughout the state. The vehicle has 10 computer workstations where staff can assist with job searches and navigate unemployment claims. The vehicle will help Iowa Workforce Development respond faster to business closings or layoff events and be present at job search workshops or hiring fairs. That's according to a press release. Governor Reynolds said in a prepared statement, "The Iowa Works Mobile Workforce Center was born out of a response to the pandemic's impact on our economy. Nearly 100,000 Iowans lost or left their jobs between January and June of 2020, and while thousands have since returned to work, Iowa still faces an urgent need for more workers. The Iowa Works Mobile Workforce Center will help ensure Iowa has the workers we need to thrive and grow by bringing career planning assistance to out-of-work Iowans anywhere in the state." A bipartisan effort would increase insurance coverage of diagnostic mammograms for Iowans. This is an article written by Nicole Grundmeier. The Affordable Care Act requires most health insurance plans to pay for women screening mammograms intended to facilitate early detection of breast cancer. But in at least 10% of cases, women are called back to get secondary scans, and the cost of the diagnostic mammograms and other procedures is not fully covered by insurance. Two similar bills advancing in the Iowa legislature would require insurers to provide the same coverage for diagnostic procedures and other supplemental examinations as they do for regular screening mammograms. State Representative Megan Serenas, a medical doctor and a Des Moines Democrat, said, "There are so many people who have breast cancer scares that need workups that are not currently covered by insurance, and because of that, delay their care, delay getting diagnosed, and end up often with far more advanced rates of cancer than they would have had we been able to get them to the care they needed when they needed it. About 1 in 8 women in the United States will at some point in their life get a breast cancer diagnosis. Even in cases where women get a clean bill of health after a diagnostic procedure, under current law, they could be on the hook for hundreds or thousands of dollars of bills." State Senator Sherrilyn Westrichsen, a Ottumwa Republican, said, "This should be seen as a screening, not as a treatment." State Senator Trone Garriott, State Senator Sarah Trone Garriott, a West Des Moines Democrat, noted that over 40% of Iowa women have dense breast tissue. Such women are more likely to need additional exams. The House and Senate bills are nearly identical. The Senate version includes additional language specifying that insurers may not impose any form of cost sharing for diagnostic procedures. Lobbyists for Wellmark Incorporated, a Des Moines-based health insurer, are registered against the Senate bill, but is undecided on the House version. Most other lobbyists monitoring the bills are registered in favor of them. Over 20 states have passed laws expanding required insurance coverage beyond screening mammograms, according to industry journal Radiology Business. State Representative Tracy Arrett, a Cedar Rapids Democrat, said, "This is something that's going to help a lot of Iowans, and this is something that could have helped me. When I was diagnosed with breast cancer last session, it was the MRI that actually caught it. It wasn't my mammogram and ultrasound that I got on a regular basis." Both bills specify that the change would cover procedures starting January 1st, 2025. The full Senate has not yet taken up the bill. The same bill must pass in both chambers and be signed by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds to become law. And again, that's an article written by Nicole Grundmeier, a staff writer and copy editor at the Business Record. She also writes for Fearless and covers arts and culture. Maximus has been selected to continue performing assessments for the Iowa Department of Human Services. This is an article written by staff at the Business Record. Maximus, a global employer and provider of governmental services, was awarded a contract from Iowa's Department of Health and Human Services to continue conducting assessments for individuals with disabilities ahead of nursing facility placement. The assessment helps ensure that individuals receive the essential services they need as part of the federally mandated process known as pre-admission screening and resident review. Maximus has supported the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services with review since 2011. The assessments take place in hospital settings, nursing facilities, or homes. Maximus contracts with Iowa-based clinicians such as therapists and psychologists to complete the assessments. And our next story with the headline, "Read Why Financial Center Owners Proposing to Convert 15 Floors to Multifamily." Owners of the 25-story financial center in downtown Des Moines are proposing converting 15 floors of the high-rise to multifamily residential, a move that is becoming increasingly common in downtowns across the United States. Walmart Capital has proposed adding up to 198 apartments to the building at 606 Walnut Street. Nearly one-third of the units would be studio apartments. The remaining units would be evenly divided between one- and two-bedroom apartments. Also planned is an 8,000-square-foot rooftop outdoor area that would include a pool as well as grilling, lounging, and gathering areas. The Des Moines City Council will vote on whether to approve an amendment to a development agreement changing the use of the finance center's lower floors from hotel to multifamily. The change is needed to allow Walmart Capital to apply for state and federal historic tax credits. In spring 2020, Walmart Capital announced the high-rise would undergo a nearly $60 million renovation that included the addition of a hotel on the building's lower floors. The pandemic, however, upended the hospitality industry, making it difficult to secure a suitable tenant, and that's according to Mark Bulizak, the CEO and managing partner of the Walmart Capital, a Canadian investment company, and told the Business Record, "We have pivoted to apartments. Since the end of the pandemic, many office-based businesses have allowed their employees to continue working remotely, either full-time or one or more days a week. The change has meant the need for less office space, both in Des Moines and nationally. In Des Moines, more than 1 million square feet, or 17.3% of the nearly 6.3 million square feet of downtown office space, is vacant, according to CBRE's 2023 fourth quarter market report. In the first quarter of 2023, downtown office vacancy was 18.3%. Cody Christensen, the city's development services director, said, It's nice to see developers taking advantage of the vacant office space and taking some of it off the market, which is helping to diversify our downtown populations. More units help with affordability. There continues to be a demand for downtown living, which we think will continue as amenities like MidAmerican Energy Company's Riverfront Park and the water trails are completed. For years, Wells Fargo occupied a large portion of the financial center. However, in 2019, the financial institution announced it was leaving the high-rise and consolidating its operations at its building at 801 Walnut Street. The departure prompted Lawmark Capital, which acquired the financial center property in 2014, to begin the multi-million dollar renovation project. Bulizek said that we knew it would be a real challenge to fill the balance of the building with office tenants. We started looking at a multi-use situation. At the time, hotels seemed like the best option. Back then, we couldn't make apartments pencil out. When Lawmark Capital officials began making decisions about its future uses, the building wasn't eligible for historic tax credits, but it is now. Bulizek said, the building is now 50 years old and we have the potential now to access tax credits. The structure was built between 1972 and 1973. He said, we still have a way to go to get across the finish line, but we're headed in the right directions. In recent years, other downtown office buildings have successfully been converted to residential uses. Bulizek said, these projects have gone through some uncharted territory to pave the way for residential in the downtown. In the past 3 years, nearly 40,000 square feet of net new office leases have been added to the building, said Jesse Bunny, Director of Operations for Lawmark Capital, about office leases in the upper 10 floors of the financial center. Bunny said, it's been tremendous. I think a lot of that will be contributed to the fact that we're thinking about our clients first. All of our amenities are for our office tenants as much as for our apartments. Lease rates are similar to other downtown properties, but the value is much higher. Amenities in the building are expected to include a restaurant, cafe, mailroom, and bike storage, all on the ground floor. The second floor, which has access to the downtown skywalk system, will include a business center, fitness center, club room, and access to the rooftop deck. A dog park will also be included. The underground heated parking garage will include at least 2 electric vehicle charging stations. An estimate on the cost to convert 15 floors of the financial center to multifamily is not yet available, Bulizek said. Construction is expected to begin in the fall with completion by April of 2026, according to a city document. That's an article written by Kathy Bolton, a senior staff writer at the Business Record. The Greater Des Moines Partnership has announced the 2024 schedule for its Top 5 for Small Business series. The Top 5 series features experts in human resources, marketing, accounting, sales, and other topics aimed at supporting small businesses. Presenters introduce 5 key points on specific topics that will help small business owners to be successful. The lineup for 2024 consists of 6 events with topics on hiring, growth, brand communications, and scaling. Each event will take place virtually via Zoom from 9 to 10 a.m. The first event is on mental health and resilience, and it's scheduled for April 24th, and more information on this series of topics is available on the website of the Greater Des Moines Partnership. The UFG Foundation awards 20 nonprofit grants. They've allocated $296,000 in its latest funding cycle to support 20 nonprofit projects in Iowa. The organization is the private foundation of UFG Insurance, a property and casualty insurance carrier. Recipients of the grants in this cycle include organizations such as Bruce Moore, the Cedar Rapids Public Library, and the Girl Scouts of Eastern Iowa. The foundation has historically prioritized funding for health and human services, arts, education, and environmental programs, contributing over $15 million to nonprofits since its inception in 1999. Homesteaders Life Company policy owners have voted to restructure into a mutual holding company. The vote took place during Homesteaders' annual policy owner meeting and follows the board of directors' unanimous vote to approve the restructuring late last year. The Iowa Insurance Division will hold a public hearing to review the proposed reorganization this spring, with final approval expected to follow shortly after. Nick Gerhardt, Chief Innovation Officer and former Insurance Commissioner for the state of Iowa, said in a prepared statement, "The simple reorganization is very common among mutual life insurers and preserves the mutual structure for the policy owners. Like the funeral profession, Homesteaders has gone through many changes over the last decade in response to the evolving business environment. This reorganization better reflects where the company is today and provides a strategic framework we can leverage to make sure we are ready for the next 100 years. In our final article from the March 8th edition of the Business Record, the Iowa Department of Insurance and Financial Services, in partnership with the Iowa Attorney General's Office and AARP Iowa, launched a statewide Stop the Scammers Fraud Education campaign and an 18-stop roadshow. The campaign's goal is to educate Iowans about the types of scams sweeping the state and how they can protect themselves, especially when it comes to online scams in the digital era. The Stop the Scammers Roadshow kicked off in Des Moines and will include 17 additional stops over the next 2 months. Those other stops include Creston, Iowa on March 27th, also on March 27th in Council Bluffs, and the same in Sioux City on the 27th of March. On March 28th, sites will be in Carroll, Iowa, Ames, Iowa, and Fort Dodge. On the 24th of April, be in Mason City, Marshalltown, Waterloo, and on May 8th in Dubuque, and on May 9th in Cedar Rapids, and on May 9th in Johnston, Iowa. You've been listening to The Business Record on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. I'm Pat Steele, and it's been my pleasure to read for you. We thank you for sharing your time with IRIS.